Okay, a couple announcements I just wanted to share with you guys. Thing number one, we're like 10 a.m. service is normative for us now, so we'll have 10 a.m. service for now here for the foreseeable future until we outgrow it. It'll probably be our basement next, then from there, who knows? Sky's the limit. We'll see. But we're going to take off. So the last Sunday of the year, I think it is, we're going to have service on the 24th, the day before Christmas, but then the 31st, we won't have service, just so you guys know. So we won't have service the last holiday, the last Sunday. So I just wanted you guys also to be aware of that. Second thing, Luke is on patrol taking pictures for our website. So look as natural as you possibly can, because we need a website and we need you to not look awkward on the website, okay? Because that, I mean, otherwise we're going to get awkward people, right? No, I'm kidding. We need awkward people too. So that's what Luke's going to be doing. Okay, last thing. We are about to start two life groups here. So I'm just going to ask the leaders of the life groups, soon to be leaders, Eric, Reagan, Callum, all you guys to stand, Joe, stand, Leslie and Elliot, stand. So these are the life group leaders. It's 3 and 3. We're going to determine the second day or when the other group meets, but probably the first week where we'll have two groups is the first week in November. So if you're interested in a group that meets once a week that does different things, maybe a couple weeks of the month it's content, 1 week is social, another week they serve the city. If you're interested in that, these are the people to talk to. Thank you. Give it up for the new life group leaders, everyone. Okay. Sweet. Now, let's talk about the message, the text that we're going to be in today. Okay, so a lot of us have been in the city now a couple months. Some of us longer, maybe a couple years. You started to meet people. You started to make friends. Maybe you've even had some spiritual conversations, finding out about people's lives. And if some of you remember, we have three basic steps to meet people that aren't Christians and to see them come to faith. The first step is meet them, get their phone number, hang out. Second step eventually is to share the gospel. And the third step, hopefully, Lord willing, is to be able to go through the Bible with them so that they are introduced to the God of the Bible and they can make that decision to follow him themselves. So they really have a clear understanding, right? Those are kind of the three steps that we follow. And you might have noticed that here, especially in the city, might be a little bit different to where you grew up. Might be a little bit different the type of people that you meet, what they're into. You might have noticed maybe you don't have a lot of shared assumptions, a lot of shared understanding about God, about life, about what's important. Maybe they don't have any religion. I mean, 32% of the city says they have no religion. That doesn't mean they're not spiritual, but they just don't identify with any specific religion. Maybe for them, a lot of people, if you ask them, they'll say, I make my own meaning. But who I am comes from within inside of me. Me following my deepest desires is the highest level of self-actualization, the highest level of identity that I can have, right? You may have noticed that for a lot of us, a lot of the people that we've met here that we love, just have very different views about the world. Maybe it's a different religion, different culture. And maybe in line with that, as you started to meet people and have conversations, maybe you've gotten a little bit discouraged. Maybe you're like, man, I came here to grow as a disciple and to make disciples. That's the mission of our church, right? To grow as disciples of Jesus and to make disciples of Jesus. It's the mission of our church. Maybe you came here and you're kind of like, man, I want to do that, but gosh, a lot of these people that I've met who I really like are so far from the God of the Bible. I mean, he doesn't appeal at all to them. They kind of hate Christians sometimes. And maybe you've gotten a little bit discouraged. You're like, man, how am I supposed to make disciples here? Nothing's a layup, okay? Nothing's easy. And you're wondering to yourself, how do I win people to Jesus in this city? With some of the interactions that I've had, it just feels so far from what I'm just so removed from their world and what they think and what they believe. And it's true. How do I win people to Jesus here? And if you're here and you're not a Christian, you're like, I don't really care about that question. I'm not trying to win anyone to Jesus, right? So I'd say fair. But also, if you're here, if you're exploring, you're thinking about faith, you're thinking about God, who is this Jesus? What does the Bible say? Is it reliable? If you're thinking about those questions, right? And then you come to the question, how would the God of the Bible tell his people to win people into the family of faith? What would he say? Wouldn't the answer to that question tell you a lot about that God? I mean, if it was coercive and violent, if that's how God told us to win people to faith, that would say a lot about him. If it was the opposite of that, if it was loving and kind, that would say a lot about him. I argue, I'm trying to make the case here, that the answer to that question rarely matters for Christians because it matters for our effectiveness. It matters for us to represent God well if we go and win people the way he has told us to. And it also matters for people that are exploring, because the answer to that question the Bible gives is going to tell you a lot about God, how he tells us to go about that, right? So how do we win people to Jesus? For Christians, it really matters for our effectiveness. We represent him well. Okay, and I'm saying that our text that we're in today, I think, answers that question in a super clear and, I think, cool way. Okay, so it's 1 Corinthians 9, 19 through 27. I mean, the ESV, if you guys want to read along with your Bibles, we actually have, we bought a bunch of Bibles. So if anyone wants these new Bibles we got from Amazon, they're just hanging out over here. If you want to follow along in the ESV, or you can just listen to me read it here. Okay, it's 1 Corinthians 9, 19 through 27. This is what it says. This is Paul talking to the Christians in the city of Corinth. And he says this: "For though I am free from all, I have made myself a servant to all that I might win more of them. To the Jews I became as a Jew in order to win Jews. To those under the law I became as one under the law, though not being myself under the law, that I might win those under the law. To those outside the law I became as one outside the law, not being outside the law of God but under the law of Christ, that I might win those outside the law. To the weak I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all people, that by all means I might save some. I do it all for the sake of the gospel, that I may share with them in its blessings. Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one receives the prize? So run that you may obtain it. Every athlete exercises self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. So I do not run aimlessly. I do not box as one beating the air, but I discipline my body and keep it under control, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified." Now, the question of how do I win people to Jesus, I think Paul addresses this super directly here. And I think there's kind of two segments to our text here, 19 through 23, if you can see it, and the second, 24 through 26. So this first segment where he's like all things to all people, right? I think verse 19 is like his thesis statement. He says, hey, "For though I'm free from all, I've made myself a servant to all that I might win more of them." And you know, that word servant, you can also translate it slave. So in that regard, he's literally saying, hey, look, though I'm free, I've made myself a slave to people that I might win them. Serve them in that regard, okay? This is like his thesis statement, one of the primary things that he's saying in that word for. The whole text starts with this word for, which means that he's arguing from what just came before our text, the pretext. And if you were to read it, this is what it's about. It's about Paul saying, hey, look, I got a lot of rights. I got a lot of freedoms in my faith in Jesus. I have the right to take a believing wife like the other apostles have, but I haven't. For the sake to remove obstacles for people that they may come to faith. He says, I have the right. I'm working in ministry full time, vocationally. I have the right to some financial compensation for that, but I haven't made use of that right to remove any obstacle from someone to coming to faith. If that's weird for them, that I get paid to minister to them, tell them about the good news of Jesus, I'm going to just take that out of the equation so it's not an obstacle. His point before our text is that he's given up his rights. He has rights, but he's given them up for the sake that they may come to faith. That's the pretext. Okay, so you're like, all right. So Paul, he's willing to do a lot. He's willing to even become a slave to serve people that they might that he might win them, that they may become a part of the family of faith. Okay, I see what he's saying. But how is he doing that? What is he doing? I see he's willing to go a long way, but what's he actually doing? And that's what I think, verse 20 through 22, that's what the meat and potatoes is. Okay? And this is what he says. He says, I become like them to win them. He says it like three or four times. He repeats it a bunch of times. I become like them to win them. Okay, here's his first group. You see it in verse 20. I become like the Jews. And by the way, I think this is the same. The second thing he says is those under the law. I think that's one group. Okay, and we're talking about under the law. He's talking about the law of Moses, the Old Testament. Those who are under the law, the Jews, they're kind of the same. I think he's just using it synonymously. So this is the first group. And he says, I become like them to win more of them. But the funny thing is he is a Jew, was a Jew, especially culturally. Okay, and Paul grew up just a thoroughbred Jew, super committed, super convicted. He calls himself a Jew of Jews at one point. And for him to now say, hey, I become like them to win them, shows how different he is since Jesus saved him. shows how much has changed for him since he became a Christian, right? Even though culturally he probably still has a lot of Jewishness about him, he's also changed a lot. And so this is the first group that he talks about. I become like them. And he starts to accommodate to them. Well, what does he mean, become like them? What's he doing? Well, what I think he means is he puts himself in their shoes. Every cultural accommodation he can make to them to make it easier, more comfortable for them to understand the faith, he does. He's willing to do basically anything. He knows their objections, knows how they think, knows what kind of questions they're going to have. This is what it means to become like them, right? And so for Jews, there's a couple like really obvious examples. The first thing is like dietary restrictions. In fact, 1 Corinthians talks about food a little bit before this, so he's probably talking about food here. For Jews, in the Old Testament, God gives the law, and part of that law is a bunch of dietary restrictions, okay? No lobster, no bacon, dude. It's a big part of being a Jew, right? That's for a couple different reasons. In the Old Testament, there's this idea of clean and unclean, and God gave this in the law to help people to understand, like, hey, there's a separation between you and me. There's people who have disobeyed me, and this kind of state of uncleanness and a state of cleanness, I just want you to be aware of this state. But for Paul, look, that was pointing to Jesus, the one who would not just make us physically clean, especially in the resurrection, but spiritually clean. All that was pointing to Jesus. So when Jesus comes along, and at one point he literally says, hey, the dietary restrictions, all foods are clean now for you if you're a Christian. So Paul, that dude can hit a surf and turf, man. That dude can eat bacon. That dude he doesn't have to adhere to the dietary restrictions anymore because he knows that in the Old Testament they were pointing to what was to come. They were pointing to the cleanness that Jesus was going to bring. But look, for Jews, that's not the case. So if he wants to persuade Jews that the God of the universe sent his son Jesus to the world to save the world because he so loves the world, if he's trying to make that case and he's hanging out with them and he's eating whatever the heck he wants and they're kind of like, it's like stressing him out, what he's saying is, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to eat what they eat. I'm going to do whatever they're doing to make it easier for them. The dietary restrictions is huge. There's a bunch of other things, though. Okay? A bunch of other things. Customs, holidays, language, like what's offensive to somebody, cultural things. There's a bunch of different things in this category, including diet. I mean, hey, some of you guys have Islamic friends you really love. Do you know what halal is? Some of you guys have friends that are Hindu that you really love. Do you know Hindu dietary restrictions? I can remember when we lived in Denver for the first 6 years, one of my neighbors, one of my closest friends was, he wouldn't say he was religiously Hindu, but very culturally Hindu. Every time we went out, it was vegetarian, every single time. Just because I knew that's what he could eat, so every time we went out, we ate veg. Okay? Do you understand the dietary, the cultural distinctions of people in your lives that you love? So there's another one, especially for Jews, that really matters. Circumcision, okay? And if you don't know what that is, I'm not going to explain it to you right now. And I honestly don't recommend you Google it, but hopefully there's somebody in your life who can explain it to you, okay? And essentially, this is why this matters for the Jews. In the Old Testament, God tells Abraham, hey, I'm going to bless the world through you. The world is going to transform through the offspring that come from you. And I'm going to give you a sign of this promise, and it's circumcision. That's where it comes from, right? But for Paul, like dietary restrictions, circumcision is a part of the law that Jesus has fulfilled. Don't need to be circumcised anymore. We could go to whole books in the Bible where he just argues really clearly, hey, circumcision was a sign in the old promise, the old way that God related to people. It was pointing to this. You don't need to be circumcised. If you have to be circumcised, you have to do all the law. And we know that the Israelites couldn't keep all the law. And we know that it was pointed to Jesus who did. Okay? Doesn't need to be circumcised. And yet, at one point, one of his proteges, Timothy, he takes him with him on his missionary journey, and he tells Timothy, hey, the guy's like in his late teens. Hey, you need to be circumcised if you're going to come do this. Another one of his proteges, Titus, he tells him, no, don't be circumcised. They're telling you need to be circumcised? No, you don't need to do that. It's not, we're not under the law anymore. Jesus fulfilled all that. You don't need to do that. Why would he say one thing to Timothy and another thing to Titus? The answer is because Timothy went with Paul on this missionary journey, partially to reach Jews. And for Paul, he's like, look, this is going to present way less of an obstacle if you would just do this. And Timothy, bless his heart, did it in his late teens. I don't know what the recovery time for that is, but it ain't short. And so it just shows you, I mean, man, that's willing to go pretty far. I'm going to undergo this surgical procedure just to remove any obstacle to this. I mean, you know, Jews are a tiny segment of the world population, right? They're going through ancient Rome. They're just a tiny segment of the population. And Paul's like, yo, these are part of the people that we want to reach. You up for it, Timothy? And apparently Timothy was like, let's do it. Okay? That is willing to go so far. That is willing to go so far to remove any obstacle, to accommodate, to make it comfortable and more approachable for them. To which you might say, well, how far? I mean, how far should we go here? I mean, we'll just become a Jew. They're going to like that, right? Which is why he says what he says in verse 20. Look at what he says here in the parenthesis. Though not being myself under the law. Look, Paul knows who he is. He knows who the Creator God is. He knows that his Son is the Lord Jesus Christ, right? And he's not going to, in this accommodation, in his willingness to become like people, he's not going to give up his identity. He knows who he is. He's not going to step back under the law, something that pointed to the ultimate fulfillment of life, Jesus Christ. He's not going to go back to that. But yo, anything else is on the table for this guy, including circumcision and your late teens, okay? Think about if that would be on the table for you. I mean, talk about willing to do anything. Talk about willing to do anything. That's how much he loves them. That's how much he wants them to know the God of the universe. That's how much he loves Jesus. Okay? And there's a word for this process, this become like them that he's talking about. There's a word for this. The word is contextualization. What does that mean? It means you accommodate to somebody's context. It means you accommodate to what they are, how they think, what they like, what they love. You're willing to submit yourself to doing the things that they do and to their world, the things that they love, to remove the obstacle. And that's such like a loving and kind thing, right? Like if you have a friend, like let's say you grow up in a family where every holiday you only are allowed to spend time with your family, not your friends. Some of us grew up in families like this. But you have a friend who's like, yo, I'll come to your house. I'll sit with your family for 12 hours on like the day before Christmas, because that's what you do. I'm up for it, dude. I mean, think about maybe some of the friends that you grew up with. Maybe you had an example of this where somebody was just willing to do whatever you guys were doing because I love you, right? This is contextualization. This is what it is. And here's the thing, guys. This is super important to realize. The gospel, which is a word that means good news, the center of the Bible, that's what the whole Bible is about, the good news of Jesus Christ. The gospel doesn't change. It's news. It's news about something that happened, okay? The gospel doesn't change. The fact that we sinned and worship creation as opposed to creator, the fact that we've rebelled against God's purposes in our lives, and that created a schism between us and God, but then God, because he so loved the world, sent his only son into the world that whoever believes in him would have eternal life and not be under condemnation. This is the gospel. This is the good news. So then Jesus, because of the justice of God, we've sinned. Something needs to be done about that. A good God's not just going to ignore evil, right? But Jesus comes down, dies for sin as your substitute, raises from the dead, showing that his authority over sin and death, and then offers that as a free gift to those who believe in him. That's the good news of the gospel. That doesn't change. But yo, if you think about different people and the backgrounds they come from, there's going to be different parts of that that appeal to people. There's going to be different aspects of that that make more sense to them than others. Maybe they really resonate with the justice part. Wait, you're saying there's a God who's just and will not let any evil thing that's ever been done be ignored? Wow. Wait, you're saying there's a God of love who, even in light of our rebellion, loves us so much, still pursued us? Wait, what you're saying? You're saying that in the Christian gospel, you're saying that God adopts us into his family? There's so many angles to the diamond of the gospel, and different parts appeal to different people in different cultures. That's a part of the work of contextualization. Hey, you're telling me that Jesus, when he died, showed that he had authority and power over death, over the spiritual enemy in the world? You're telling me he's the name above every name? He's the name above every name? You know, being able to understand which parts of the gospel appeal to different people in your life is a huge part of contextualization, a huge part of putting yourself in their shoes and understanding what makes sense to them and what resonates to them, right? Because it goes beyond just food, clothing, fun, drink. It goes beyond all that, right? That's almost just like step one. Step two is the big questions they're asking. Step two is, I mean, depends on the person, depends on the culture, what questions they're asking, right? You're telling me, how does my shame get removed? How does, what happens when I die, right? What's the purpose of my life? The big questions. Contextualization isn't just food, drink, clothes, fun stuff, all that, that Paul's talking about clearly. It's also that. The questions, the objections that they would have. And Paul is saying, I'm willing to do all things. I'm willing to become all things to all people to save them, right? And so it's not just Jews, but verse 21, not just Jews and those under the law, but those outside of the law, Gentiles, Greeks, Romans for him. What's a Gentile? It's just somebody who's not a Jew. That's how the Jews refer to, it was basically probably all of us, okay? We're Gentiles. We're those outside of the law. We didn't grow up under the Torah, okay? And Paul's saying also to them, I will become all things to all people. Like, think about this. If you're Paul, or if you're talking to someone in the city who's not a Jew, and they're not a Christian, I mean, imagine if you went to them and were like, yo, but like Jesus, the Old Testament talks about him. They're going to be like, so? I don't care about the Old Testament. What is that? This sounds like an ancient document that has nothing to do with me, right? So when Paul's becoming like them, oh, we're talking about something totally different now. Different religious connotations for them, different dietary stuff, different, I mean, the Greeks love philosophy, okay? In one minute, Paul's like accommodating himself to like a Jewish dietary restriction. In the next minute, he's having a high Greek philosophy conversation. You can actually see this in Acts. When he's reasoning with Jews, he's like, look, Old Testament, see, it predicted Jesus was going to come. See, he's the Messiah. See, look, it makes sense. Old Testament, see? But then with Greeks, he's like, yo, as I walked into your city, I saw this altar. It said to the unknown God. Let me tell you about him. This is who he is. Okay? And then he appeals to creation, nature, stuff that we're all kind of familiar with. He accommodates the way he reasons and the way he persuades to who he's talking about based on what appeals to them. This is contextualization. And we're talking about, in verse 21, to those who are not under the law, Gentiles, Greeks, us, right? And, I mean, think about Paul's flexibility here, okay? To go from really unique, just really niche cultural accommodations to somebody like Jews or a Hindu or a Muslim, okay? From that to like high Greek philosophy, I mean, this is major cultural flexibility that he's putting forward to us, right? Major cultural flexibility. And I think this is really helpful for us because we're talking about Denver. I mean, talk about a city not under the law, right? Talk about a city that has nothing to do with, and the people here care so little about the God of the Bible, right? Like I said, 32% claims no religion at all, let alone other religions. And so this paradigm, not under the law, is super applicable to us, right? I mean, you're in a city of 700,000 people, metro area of 3 million, okay? There's a lot of different types of people that believe a lot of different types of things, okay? But there's recognizable types nonetheless. Let me give you one archetype Denver person, okay? Person in their early 20s, they move here. And you ask them, hey, why'd you move here? And they go, I just wanted to be in Denver. People move to different cities for different reasons, right? You're going to New York, LA, Chicago, San Francisco. There's a good chance you're going for career. There's a good chance you're going for the opportunity to advance your career, to get it to a certain part, right? You're going to the Midwest. Good chance you're going for your family, to go back with your family, to go back with, get affordable space, to go back to that the values that you appreciate and you resonate with. Texas, affordability, maybe ideology. I mean, it just really depends, right? People go to different cities for different reasons. What I'm saying is, if you ask people why they moved here, and they're in their early 20s, and they just moved here, one of the things that you're going to hear all the time is, I just came here to be here. I mean, look, it's glorious. Why would I not want to be here? They came here for the good life. They came here for the coffee, the beer, the food, the relationships, the balance with nature and work. Right? They're not trying to work 100 hours a week in a high rise in downtown New York City. They have different values. Okay, maybe this person doesn't resonate with institutional religion like a Christianity or something else, but they're very spiritual. They think about the immaterial spiritual things. Right? This is crazy. In 1990, the average age of this city was 34. That's young as far as cities go. Okay. The average age of the city in 1990 was 34. Guess what it is now? 34. The city is forever young, dude. Just an endless stream of young people coming into the city, looking for life. As people age, maybe they move out to the suburbs or they move to a different state, such that it's just forever young. People coming here looking for meaning, looking for life, looking for satisfaction. This is one of the archetypes. There's many others, though, right? Maybe you're talking about a young Hispanic guy. Grew up in the same house, 25 years, okay, with 6 or 7 or 8 other people. Bunch of siblings. He grew up Catholic, but if you ask him what he believes now, he might be like, I don't know. I don't know that I would call myself a Catholic. I might call myself something else, right? Or maybe it's a young woman who associates with the New Age movement. She practices witchcraft because she's spiritual and she sees that there's some type of power in some of these things. And for we as Christians, we would say that those things do have power. We would just say it's empowered by the spiritual enemy, right? But she's attracted to this. She sees this. It's bringing some dynamicness to her life. Maybe she's vegan. Maybe she loves nature, finds a lot of meaning in nature. You're going to encounter so many different types of people in this city with backgrounds and assumptions completely different to Christianity. Completely different to Christianity. My question to us is this. Have you entered their world or just asked them to enter yours? Have you entered their world or just asked them to enter yours? Because what do you think we're seeing with Paul here? We're talking about a zeal, a love, a flexibility to become all things to all people, no matter what their background is. And again, he's not willing to do anything. So this is why he says what he says in, let's see, what he says in 21. Look at what he says. To those outside the law, became as one outside the law, not being outside the law of God, but under the law of Christ. By that he means, look, somebody invites me to the strip club, I'm not going. Right? Like all my friends that I love, they go out and they're getting hammered. Like I know who Jesus made me to be. I know the way he's purposed these things in my life. I'm not going to compromise morally and do something outside of my identity for the sake of accommodating them. Same with the Jews, right? He's not going to adopt their worldview. Same thing over here. Those outside the law, he's not, you guys, right? He's not going to just do whatever. There's a two helpful guardrails for him, right? But yo, anything else is on the table. He's willing to contextualize anything else. Verse 22 is the last one, the weak person. This could mean several things here. Earlier in the book, he says, hey, guys, Corinthians, not many of you guys are wise or powerful or rich. Okay, apparently, this is the Corinthian church. This is what they're like. So he could be referring to that. That they're weak in that regard. He could also be referring to something he talks about a few chapters earlier where, a weak person is someone who hasn't like fully understood the freedom they have in Jesus. And so they adhere to all these weird things, even though they don't really need to. It's not wrong, but it's also like, hey, you're free. Jesus has given you a lot of freedom. Could be that. Regardless, for the Jew, the Gentile, the weak person, this is what Paul says about it. He says, I become all things to all people, that by all means, I might save some. Okay? He's culturally flexible, willing to serve them. But this shouldn't shock us, right? I mean, look, if the Bible says that all people are made in God's image. All people have a part of God's image in them. Now, it's a little bit marred because of sin. But if that's the case, then in every culture, we should be able to find stuff that's amazing. In every culture, we should find things that reflect the God who made them. So there should be things with the people that you meet, the people that you love, different cultures, different value systems, different backgrounds. There should be things that you're like, that is amazing. And you know what? I actually see the Creator God reflected in that. You should be able to affirm different things about them. Have you noticed those things? Or have you just thought overcritically? Oh, look at all these things. You're so different than how I grew up. Okay, yeah, sure. But there's also things that reflect the fact that they're in God's image. Do you see those things? And so too, every culture, because every person is born into sin and has rebelled against God, because of that, every culture has parts about it that need to be challenged, that need to be pointed out, the inconsistencies, that need to be shown how it's not in line with the God of the Bible. All of us and every culture has parts that should be affirmed and parts that should be challenged. Think about the flexibility that gives you. You don't have to walk into relationships with people that are different than you and just be like, and just be super judgmental. That's not what the God of the Bible is showing us to do here. That's not how Paul is dealing with this. If he becomes all things to all people, there's all kinds of affirmation happening. You should see the way he reasons in some of these other books. That's exactly what he's doing. Okay? The core truth of the gospel has super broad appeal because of this. And guys, by the way, the Bible is literally written in three languages. Okay? The whole thing, Old Testament, a couple languages, New Testament, a couple languages, written in three languages by people from a multiplicity of cultural backgrounds. The Bible itself, the Word of God, is itself multicultural. And as far as my research goes, I don't think there's one other religious text like that. Not one. In fact, if you think about it, you have to really adopt not just other religions' theological convictions. Hey, what's the truth about God? This is what it is. You don't just have to adopt that. You have to adopt their culture. Wear this. Speak like this. Speak this language. Not with the Bible. You want to know why? Because its truth transcends culture and is present in every culture to some degree, right? That should be affirmed and should also be challenged. The Bible itself is multicultural, which is why the spread of Christians across the world is pretty even across the continents. North America, 17% of all Christians. South America, maybe 16%. Europe, maybe 18%. Africa, 15%. Southeast Asia, 18%. I mean, it's spread across the world because it appeals to something in everyone. Because it's the transcendent truth from the Creator God. Right? Now, here's the last section. Verses 24 through 27. Okay? The first section we see, which we can kind of summarize as Paul becomes all things to all people. He contextualizes, right? And here's the last little chunk here. This part about discipline. This part about this athlete metaphor, all right? And it's kind of funny because in verse 24, he's like, do you not know that in a race, all the runners won, but only one receives the prize? And it's kind of like, if you're a Christian, you're like, what? But in Christianity, like, tons of people receive the prize. Tons of people receive the free gift of grace from Jesus, right? But this is what Paul is saying, like, compete. Discipline yourself. He's talking about self-discipline. Discipline yourself like only one person wins, dude. That's how hard you should work. That's how hard you should work. Well, for what though? Right? What's he talking about? Well, he's talking about self-discipline. And the immediate context is this missionary activity, this idea of contextualizing yourself and your message of the gospel to the people around you. That's what he just talked about. So when he's talking about self-discipline, that's what I think he's talking about with self-discipline. But he also says at the end here, 27, but I discipline my body and keep it under my control, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified. So I think what he's also talking about is his own holiness, his own obedience to God. He's like, I also got to watch myself because I know my temptation to continue to sin and rebel against God is still there, even though Jesus has saved me. And so I'm going to stay focused. I'm going to stay self-disciplined, right? A helpful definition of discipline is giving up what you want now for what you want most. Think about that. Giving up what you want now for what you want most. So many things apply to this. You want to run a marathon? You better give up the comfort of that bed in the morning. Get up and start running. You want to feel good? You want to be healthy? Better think about what you eat. Give up the cheeseburger. Give up the candy bar. Give up the pint of ice cream for the eighth time that day for something a little healthier. You want to gain a skill? You want to be someone who's an expert in something? You better start working at it. This is self-discipline. This is what he's talking. This is the imagery that he's using. And the context is being a missionary. The context is his own faithfulness, right? And so for us, as people that are here in Denver, who we believe God sent us here to bring the love of Jesus to people, we should discipline ourselves to that degree, like an athlete does. Part of the argument that he makes is like, look, with an athlete, they work hard. And I mean, think about the Greek games. This is where the idea of the Olympics comes from, guys. It comes from the Greeks, right? And what they would do is in Olympia and in some other surrounding cities every so often, all these athletes come and they compete. Their crown that they would get if they won was literally made of celery. Fresh, crisp celery. Boom. Put it on their head, right? I don't know if you've ever left celery out or in the fridge for 2 days, but it gets nasty and floppy in like 48 hours, okay? And Paul's saying, look, that they compete for a wreath. It's cool, but it's perishable, dude. We're competing for something that lasts for eternity. How much more significant? Look at what the athlete does. You willing to do that for your life and the people that you love? That's his point. That's his point. It's a really, you know, the funny thing about this illustration is he uses this metaphor for Corinthians. Okay, this is a real city that you can go to. You can go to Corinth. And Corinth is a 2-hour drive from Olympia, where the Greek games began. Okay? And not only that, I mean, a two-hour drive for Jews back then, it would have been like a couple days walk, but it's close, is my point. And there's also a big athletic competition that happened in Corinth. For Paul to literally, look at this, for Paul to literally use this athletic metaphor and talk about the like Greek games and the wreath, he's literally contextualizing to them. He didn't grow up with that in Tarsus, 1,000 miles away. But here he is, writing to Corinthians, both Jewish and Greek background, who understand what the Greek games are. He's like, for example, you know that thing that happens every year, every couple of years, that like really matters, the whole city goes crazy, the Olympics for them, right? And they're like, oh yeah, yeah, oh, I know exactly what that. He's literally contextualizing to them. In the literal text he's writing to them. He's doing the thing he's calling believers to do. You see that? Nuts. Nuts. It goes beyond just food, music, loves, but goes to the big questions. This is what we're talking about with contextualization, self-discipline, right? Find things you can affirm, but also things you can challenge. What do you mean you think science is the only, when you say science is the only way to know truth, right? What do you mean by that? Well, I mean, so science is the only way to know truth. Like, can you prove that statement scientifically? Well, no. Okay, so we're actually not that far apart. You have some philosophical truth statements, so do I. And even though you say the only truth that is true, it comes from science, you can't even prove that statement without you relying on what I use, right? Like, things need to be affirmed, some things need to be challenged. Do you know what those things are? Okay, Paul becomes all things to all people, and he is focused on self-discipline to bring that reward. Now, we started with this question. We started with this question of how do I win people to Jesus here, right? It says a lot about the God of the Bible, the way he calls his people to contextualize to the way people are and affirm the image of God that they see in them. Think about what that says about the God of the Bible. Just the gentleness, the kindness, the pursuit, right? We started with that question, and now we see God's play call with this. Become all things to all people with those boundaries that Paul mentions. Okay, we're not going to compromise morally. We're not going to adopt some other worldview. But anything else, we're willing to. Anything else, we're willing to. This is the play call. This is contextualization. This is what it is. This is our message. This is our method, right? Paul disciplines himself for him to see this accomplished. But it's worth remembering. It's worth remembering this work that we need to do. It's worth remembering that it's God, actually, that saves. It's God actually that saves. You see, in the midst of our work is this beautiful truth that the hard work is already done. When Jesus died, went to the cross and died, he said, "It is finished. The hard work is done. The payment for sin has been made." And it's God ultimately that saves people. And so in the midst of this encouragement for Paul to stay focused and work hard and contextualize, be thoughtful, love these people well, in the midst of all that lies this beautiful truth that the hard work's done. And you know, you might have the reasonable objection of, well, if it's God that saves, why would I contextualize? Why would I go and bring the message to people, right? I just want you to see that that's the opposite logic of the Bible. The opposite logic of the Bible's logic is, hey, God's done the hard work. He's the one that saved people. And how glorious is it for you to be front row? How glorious is it for you to get to be a part of it? That's the Bible's logic. Hard work is done, but in your effort, in your work, you glorify God. And by the way, it's the most satisfying thing because you're living in your purpose. And look, how well you do that, that doesn't determine if you're saved. Your works, your efforts, how hard you try is never going to determine if you are saved. The only thing that determines that is your faith in Jesus. That's how the free gift of God is received, right? The hard work is already done. Somebody ran the race and won for you and hands you the trophy at the end. That's the Lord. That's the amazing news about the gospel of peace. That's the logic of the Bible. The race is finished. So let's follow Jesus' play call and contextualize. Amen. Let's represent him well and become all things to all people, accommodating to them, removing any obstacle, loving them, serving them in any way humanly possible to remove the obstacle. Amen? So we're going to take communion now. Lydia, where's Lydia? If you wouldn't mind getting up and passing this out. We're going to take communion now. which is something that Christians do. Why do we do it? Because Jesus told us to. This is what communion is. Ready? Here's a helpful passage from 1 Corinthians that describes what it is. This is Paul again. For I received from the Lord, that's Jesus, for I received from the Lord what I also delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the night when he was betrayed, took bread, and when he had given thanks, broke it, and said, this is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me. In the same way, he also took the cup after supper, saying, this cup is the new covenant of my blood. Do this as often as you drink it, in remembrance of me. For as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. As Christians, we take communion in remembrance of the one who already ran the race. Remembrance of the one who gives us the free gift of grace. This is what communion is. We remember Jesus' body broken, his blood poured out for us. We remember his love, right? So as this comes, Paul's going to start to play here. Sorry, do you need this? As this comes out, Paul's going to start to play here. He's got a few more songs. And let's take it together here. How are we doing? Go over, yeah, thanks. There you go. All right, let's take the body, the bread, representative of Jesus' body together.